From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you, and we're very thankful for you and all of the others. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
Hey, I'm the first one to say it's a great country, but it's a strange culture. We got a strange culture.
For years, the Public Religion Research Institute has offered insightful surveys detailing what Americans believe and how they are likely to express those beliefs culturally and politically. Values, morals, preferences, and objections all have come into play. Now, a remarkably comprehensive, interactive resource from PRRI takes the available level of understanding even further with last week's unveiling of the online American Values Atlas. On this week's show, Institute President Dr. Robert P. Jones will be with us to explain what the Atlas can do and what we can glean from its wealth and data.
The feminists, who are they to decide what a woman should or should not do? They're the ones putting, you know, limitations on how women are supposed to live their lives. These attacks on traditional gender roles and responsibilities. So now they're saying, well, you don't need a mom and a dad. You know, you could have two mommies or two daddies, or you could have a mommy and a daddy who used to be a mommy but now is daddy, you know, thanks to gender reassignment surgery. I mean, it's very confusing to the average person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very confused.
Divide and conquer is an age-old strategy for victory in war as well as in conflicts. The opposite strategy can be equally effective, bringing allied groups together because there's strength in numbers. As members of minority groups find themselves increasingly marginalized in parts of Africa and beyond, particularly LGBT persons and women, there are leaders working to build bridges that will be essential for change to take place. Prominent among those workers is the Reverend Canon Albert Ogle, and we'll highlight his work to promote coalitions at the United Nations and beyond on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
if you have questions about your faith, if you have doubts about your faith, there are communities online and increasingly on campuses and high schools and college where you can explore that without the fear of backlash. And that's what we want to promote. We want people thinking about that and questioning and doubting.
An invaluable resource for State of Belief Radio has long been the Friendly Atheist blog on the Patheos online community, authored by Hemant Mehta. It offers timely updates and commentary on issues of relevance to this nation's sizable atheist and humanist population, and it is of interest and importance to all of us. Relentlessly living up to the name of his blog, Hemant cheerfully agreed to be with us in a long-delayed State of Belief interview. So, Hemant, welcome at last to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Talk about the genesis of the Friendly Atheist site. How did you get started?
Sure. The short version of the story is I had started visiting a bunch of Christian churches for the first time in my life as sort of a sociological experiment.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't just want to go for the sake of understanding what they were doing there, but I wanted to write about it. And so I ended up doing it on another website. But when that kind of experiment was over, that was the first time I could put up my thoughts and opinions on some subject and get a lot of immediate feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of thrill you get when that happens. So I decided I wanted to keep talking about religion. And so I started this website about 7 or 8 years ago now, Friendly Atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for the name is simply the idea that every time I saw atheist mentioned in the news, it was always preceded by some really nasty adjective, like
mm-hmm.
an angry atheist or a militant atheist. And all the atheists I know are really nice, kind, happy people.
Yeah.
And so I figure if nothing else, if I made it Friendly Atheist, at least if anyone ever quoted it, they would have to use those words together.
Well, a lot of people want you to be miserable.
They want me to be what?
They want you to be miserable.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? I try not to give them the fodder they want. Believe me, there are times I chastise atheists as much as I chastise kind of the far right when it comes to religion.
I know that's true. I see your website and appreciate it. This isn't in any kind of script we have, but I'm just curious. When you started visiting churches, well, you don't have to name them, but what kind of churches did you go to right off?
Well, for the experiment I was doing, they were limited to mostly non-denominational Christian churches.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, there were a few mega churches, but there were also some smaller offshoot churches. There was a church in one guy's house because he had just started up.
Uh-huh.
It was trying to give me a admittedly superficial look at the type of churches Christians have. I went to an all-black church on the south side of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
An almost all-white church in another part of the in another suburb of Chicago. And then when I was writing a book, which was called I Sold My Soul on eBay,
mm-hmm.
I ended up visiting a few different cities. So I saw Joel Osteen's church in Houston, Texas, and
right.
Ed Haggard when he was preaching in Colorado.
Yeah.
So it was a variety of churches, but mostly evangelical ones.
Hamad, when you were doing that, and I really do admire you doing that, were your feelings, did you feel anger? Did you feel repulsion? Did you feel, I've got to address this? What were your feelings?
You know what? Some of it was I have to address this, but that wasn't a surprise. Like, Christians talking about Christianity, that's not a shocker, you know what I mean? But I was actually pleasantly surprised because, I mean, some of the churches I went to, they were doing really incredible volunteer work.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they were proselytizing along the way, and I disagree with that, but they were really helping a lot of people. And what was really interesting is to see how much community they had in a lot of these places. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you could practically live your whole life within the bubble of the church.
Mm-hmm.
They got you covered from the moment you're born to when you're, you know, a retiree.
Yes.
And everything in between. They don't care if you're single or married. They have something for you. If you lost your job, they got you covered.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, religion or not, that's a pretty powerful thing to
right.
have. This is something I've said to atheists for a long time. You may think you have the argument to convince people God doesn't exist, but that's not enough to get them to leave their church. You got to offer them more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
these churches really have that other non-God aspect of it covered.
Mm-hmm. What has been the most rewarding part of this kind of journalism?
I think more than anything else, I constantly hear from people who alert me to things that are going on in their own communities that they think no one will notice, and I'll pick up on it. And they just want to thank me for being visible. And I know every atheist I've ever talked to who does anything publicly, whether it's a blog or YouTube or a podcast, they constantly get letters from people who say, thank you, because I feel more comfortable in my shoes as an atheist. I feel like I can talk to someone about it after meeting you or listening to you. And, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I don't really care if anyone becomes an atheist as a result of reading my site. That's nice, but I don't really care. It's about whether you've changed your mind about atheism.
Mm-hmm.
Are you more willing to say, okay, atheists aren't as bad as I thought they were?
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten a lot of feedback that suggests, yes, that has been happening, and that's really rewarding.
Yeah, I can imagine so. You've published a number of books. There's one in particular I'd like to talk about, the one titled The Young Atheist Survival Guide. There are so many circumstances in this country where I would think this book would just be essential. So talk, if you will, about what you wanted to achieve in writing that book.
Sure. Well, you know, the Interfaith Alliance, you know this really well. There are a lot of instances where young atheists, all they want to do in high school is talk about their beliefs with a like-minded crowd,
mm-hmm.
or maybe have a pleasant, civil debate. And in a lot of schools, there are obstacles to forming those after-school groups, which is completely illegal. Like, you can have Bible clubs in school. You can have religious clubs and non-religious clubs in school. And a lot of administrators assume that kids don't know better, so they'll just put obstacles in the way. Mm-hmm. And that's just one example. There's also more social aspects, such as when someone comes out as an atheist. And in some parts of the country, that becomes like you're a pariah all of a sudden. People are mocking you. They're threatening you in some cases. And so this book was sharing some of those stories and talking about what the rest of us who aren't necessarily, you know, a teenager anymore, what can all of us do as parents and teachers and community members to help those students? Because what they're asking for isn't anything out of the ordinary. And all they're asking for is like a chance to meet and talk about their beliefs and not be harassed because of it.
What kind of responses have you received to the Young Atheist Survival Guide?
Again, a very positive response. I heard from atheists who said, it was nice knowing I'm not the only one going through these problems. I heard from Christians who said, you know, I understand what you're saying, and I feel the need to help people who might be atheists. Even if I disagree with them, they have the right to do the things that Christians always get a right to do.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think the impact was as intended. People got the sense that this wasn't about trying to make you into an atheist. It's about helping the atheists who are already out there.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, as you know, it's become vogue in recent days to ask leading political figures about President Obama's faith. When you see ridiculous conversations like that in the press, what's it leave you thinking of the society that we inhabit?
Oh, man. It's very frustrating. One, that, look, you have to take what someone says at face value. President Obama has said he's a Christian. And what's really funny is that if you look at the far right wing, he says he's a Christian, but they all think he's like a secret Muslim. One, who cares if he was a Muslim? But two, like, they're wrong. He's not. He said as much. What's funny is in some atheist circles, though, you'll see people hear Obama say he's a Christian, but they're like, yeah, but he's secretly an atheist. Like, you're kind of guilty of the same sin there.
Mm-hmm.
This guy has said at face value, I am a Christian. I believe the following things. Okay, fine. Who cares what they believe? What's more important is, even if he is a Christian, is he pushing through legislation? Is he supporting legislation that promotes his faith?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could see on the record, he's not interested in using the government to advance his religion. At that point, I don't care what someone believes. I don't care what they believe if they're trying to get government to promote it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my problem. And believe me, there are atheists I would not vote for. There are deeply conservative Christians I would vote for because they know the separation of church and state. And as far as Obama goes, I think overall he's done a good job of that. But though there are always things that he does that frustrate me, as someone who wants to keep church and state separate, speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast, using religious language in some of his rhetoric. Again, some worse than others, but overall, I think it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, absolutely. The opening remarks, when I asked you about your feelings when you visited those churches of various varieties, I'm interested in the fact that you observed the fellowship and the kind of camaraderie or interactions that went on there. Against that backdrop, I want to ask you, what's your reaction to the movement? I don't think it's a great movement yet, but it's certainly going somewhere, to have what are called atheist churches.
I like it. And I'll tell you this, it's not something that appeals to me personally. For example, there is a Sunday assembly group outside of Chicago. It's a little far away from me, and I really don't attend it much. But again, we talked earlier about the need for that community. As the founder of that particular organization has said, Christians don't have a monopoly on singing or giving inspirational talks or, you know, gathering as a community and supporting each other. They don't have a monopoly on that. So why can't atheists do something similar, you know, inspire and sing and gather but without any of the religion stuff. I believe the analogy he uses is if your shoe had a rock in it, you wouldn't throw away the whole shoe. You'd just get rid of the rock and keep walking. And I think that idea makes a lot of sense. Go ahead and let's provide atheists with the sort of community aspect that Christians do so well and not include all the stuff we consider nonsense. I think that's powerful. And for a lot of people who have recently left their faith, that provides a really nice stepping stone because you may not believe in God, but you're afraid of losing your social circle and you're afraid of losing that, you know, ritual and the volunteering that comes along with being part of a church.
Right.
And here's a perfect way to just kind of step away from it and not lose everything that's so good about church.
Amant, you you cover a lot of upsetting stories in your blog with overt hostility coming to atheists and skeptics rampant in our culture. How do you manage to stay friendly?
You know, it's a matter of figuring out who's doing it. Most of the people who are religious, who are reading this stuff, they are on the right side of the issue, which is not to say that they are atheists, but that they understand separation of church and state. The people who do these awful things, they tend to be a handful of politicians, a handful of right-wing groups. It's not everybody. They may talk like they represent everybody, but they don't. And again, if you hear from a lot of Christians who comment on the website, they're usually on my side of the issue on these things. I mean, it's. I think I'm optimistic when I see the awesome things that I see a lot of atheist groups doing and Christian groups sometimes doing in response. And I try to highlight those as much as I can. But usually when it's upsetting stories, they involve a handful of players or government situations. And it's, believe it or not, it's a lot of the same stories over and over because sometimes these things just trend. For example, right now we're seeing this a push to get In God We Trust displays on city council meetings and city halls all over the country. That's the same story happening all over the place, but you see very different reactions depending on where it happens. So these things come in waves, but I don't know. There's enough to stay optimistic about that kind of buttresses all the negativity.
Well, Amant, you know, and I know, and others should know that your site is more than a blog. It really is a community. So I don't want to quit before you tell our listeners how they could get involved in your work, how they can follow what you're doing.
Sure. The easiest thing is to visit Friendly Atheist, one word, friendlyatheist.com, and that'll take you to the site. And everything else I do, whether it's YouTube videos or a podcast or anything, all the links are right there. So that's the easiest way to go. And again, come check it out. And believe me, if you disagree with me on something and you want to call me out on it, I won't bite. But usually the conversations I have with readers are pretty positive.
Amant Mehta is the author of the Friendly Atheist pages on the Pantheos community site, the author of numerous books. He offers comprehensive and calm coverage of some of the more provocative stories confronting atheist humanists, skeptics, and all of us who are interested in church-state separation in our country and the strength of religious liberty in our Constitution. Amant, I thank you so much for being with us today, and I look forward talking with you again.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I cannot count the number of times Public Religion Research Institute founding president Dr. Robert P. Jones has been with us to offer insights into the landscape of American values, opinion, diversity, trends, all of it terribly important and enlightening information. Taking their gathering and distillation of data one step further, PRRI has just unveiled the interactive online American Values Atlas, and I am delighted to welcome Dr. Jones back to the show to tell us all about it. Robbie, congratulations, and welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks, Welton. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, first things first, what is this Atlas and what can it do?
Well, you know, it is an online interactive web interface that I think hopefully brings, you know, power to the people. It's designed to we have built out a massive database of 50,000 interviews conducted throughout 2014 that allows you to look across all 50 states, even down into the largest 30 metro areas, and look at the changing religious landscape in the country, the changing political landscape in the country, and also some attitudes on some key issues such as immigration reform, same-sex marriage, and abortion.
Goodness. Well, give us some examples of questions that the resource can help a user answer.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things, we're about to enter, you know, presidential primary season not too long from now, and, you know, one of the things I guess users could do, for example, is we have state profiles. So you could go to New Hampshire or Iowa, some of the early primary states, and you can see kind of at a glance the political makeup, the religious makeup of the country, and then they're, you know, kind of the attitudes of those residents of New Hampshire on these key issues, same-sex marriage and immigration, just to make it concrete. But you can also see, I think, some big-picture things. So let me give you a couple of examples of kind of the big-picture things about the religious landscape and kind of ethnic landscape changes. So for the first time ever, we're finding that 2014, America is not a majority Protestant nation. So in 2014, only 47% of Americans identified as Protestant. Now, that differs a lot in state to state. So, for example, Mississippi, my home state, is 81% Protestant. So that, you know, it's not the same all over the country. But we are seeing a lot of changes. You know, we see more than one in five Americans are religiously unaffiliated, for example. That also differs across states. But, in fact, well, here's a striking number, though, that in 13 states, the religiously unaffiliated are the largest, you know, so-called religious group in that state. So they're larger than any other major religious group in the state. And so that's, you know, some of these kinds of insights are the kind of things that people can click around. You can zoom into states. You can zoom back out to region level and kind of compare and contrast to your heart's content.
You know, I would hope, after having looked at it myself, that no one come to the conclusion that this is a resource just for media outlets and professional researchers. Talk for a second about how useful it would be for all kinds of people.
Yeah. Well, we have built it as a fairly simple interface. It's not really designed for researchers. It really is designed for the general public to get a better idea. You know, if you think back to the kind of origins of public opinion research, you know, George Gallup, Elmo Roper, some of these early guys, they really saw public opinion data as a tool for democracy and for helping Americans both understand the opinions of the country as a whole and helping policymakers understand and hear the voices of everyday Americans. And so we're hoping that this tool will serve that purpose. You know, it's pretty easy, for example, to take a look at on an issue like immigration reform, you know, where right now the country's mired in, you know, a possible shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security over riders on the funding bill, and also a court case where 26 Republican governors have taken the Obama administration to court and sued over his executive action on immigration reform. And, you know, one of the things we find here is that on an issue like that where it seems like there's a lot of partisan rancor, it turns out that actually Americans across the border are quite in agreement. So, for example, majorities of Americans, like 6 in 10 Americans, say that there should be for immigrants who are in the country illegally, they should be allowed a path to citizenship. That is true for all 50 states in the country. So residents of every state in the country are in majority support, as are a majority of Republicans, independents, and Democrats. That's something you probably wouldn't know from the rancor in the media, but when you have a chance to look at the data, you actually see that on an issue like immigration reform, Americans are actually largely on the same page, despite how divided our leaders are.
Robbie, after fooling with this for a while, one of the questions that came to my mind is, how in the world are you going to keep this thing up to date?
Well, I think with a lot of work, but we're committed to the task. I mean, one of the things we wanted to make sure that we did is that this would not be a one-shot thing. So we are actually committed as an organization to updating this resource, which requires conducting more than 50,000 interviews with a random sample of Americans each year in order to get a full 50-state portrait of the country. But we're committed to kind of keeping this up every year. So we are actually already in the field as we speak collecting data for the 2015 version of the American Values Atlas that will be out about this time next year.
I knew you had a good answer. I just was thinking what a monumental task that is. You've shown us already in your through your comments how this can benefit someone looking for information about religions in the United States. You've also given us a little bit of analysis on other areas of American life like politics and economics. Tell us, what are some of the most useful features of this atlas? How does it go beyond the typically comprehensive surveys that you normally release?
Well, a couple of ways. I mean, one is that we can really dive down more deeply into understanding smaller groups than we can typically get, even with, you know, fairly large survey. And it's just worth saying that, to put this in perspective, you know, a typical public opinion survey, you know, is about 1,000 people. Even usually at PRI, we do larger surveys than that. But even our largest surveys are typically less than 5,000 people. This is 10 times that size. So that's the scale we're at. But what that allows us to do is to, for example, look at groups like Mormons, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, other smaller groups that we can never really get an accurate picture of. But this data set allows us to actually see those groups. And for larger groups, it really allows us to also see the kinds of precision and actually like breaks by age. For example, we have almost 8,000 white evangelical Protestants in the sample. Now, that allows us to do some very, you know, important looks at what younger white evangelical Protestants believe, for example, versus older evangelical Protestants, which is something that is very limited in smaller data sets.
Mm-hmm. What does it take, Robbie, to compile all of this data, 50,000 interviews? What's all this involve?
We basically call 1,000 people a week and survey 1,000 people a week over 50 weeks in the year. And then we do a lot of work cleaning and combining that data set into the final data set that you're able to use online today.
What else do our listeners need to know about this resource to encourage them to make use of it?
Well, I hope that, you know, they just bring their curiosity and their, you know, index finger to click is really all you need. I'm hoping, you know, it'll be, you know, so for pastors, for example, you know, if you have pastors really want to know something about if they're in a major metropolitan area in their home state, how things are changing, students who are interested in the changing, you know, landscape around them or in a state that they're studying or an area that they're studying. I really do think this has got a pretty wide use and should be, you know, simple to use.
And the address to go to is www.ava.publicreligion.org.
That's correct.
Robbie, I've got a question. This is related, I promise. When did you come to Washington?
Let's see. I came to Washington back in 2005 and then spent some time doing, you know, consulting around Washington, D.C. and at various places, and then finally founded PRI in 2009.
In 2005, you came to my office at Interfaith Alliance and shared something of the dream that you had about working in Washington. And I have watched you carefully across these years, and your vision is rapidly becoming a reality. And I can't close this interview without telling you how proud I am of what you've done and how meaningful your vision is once we see it incarnate in this kind of release today and of the releases that you do all the time informing us. I really am grateful for that.
Well, that's so generous and kind, and I want to say, you know, thanks right back to you. I mean, you were one of the first people that I talked to in Washington, D.C. as I was trying to sort of sort out career paths and work here, and, you know, without, I think, the generosity of folks like you, we certainly wouldn't be here. So thanks to you.
Well, you know, the challenge is our producer will probably delete what you just said about me and keep what I said about you, but that'll be okay. Dr. Robert P. Jones is president of the Public Religion Research Institute. PRRI has just unveiled a remarkable new online resource, the Interactive American Values Atlas. You can find it at www.ava.publicreligion.org. Robbie, you've given us a sneak peek. I think it should tease people's inquisitive enough that they will be going to this website right away. Thanks so much for being with us today to introduce this to our listeners here on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Weldon.
The Reverend Canon Albert Ogle is an Anglican clergyman who has served as a leader in the struggle for human rights across the globe. He's been doing that for many years. Today, his focus is on building critical momentum for progress through bringing together advocates for women's rights and LGBT rights. This is vitally important work, and so I am happy to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Albert, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Weldon. It's good to be back and talking with you.
Would you begin by talking briefly about what's called the Riverside Coalition? What is it, and who's a part of it?
Well, the Riverside Coalition was formed just a couple of months ago by some of the faith-based groups that have been working around the United Nations and working around issues of women's, gender equality, LGBT rights. And we have Unitarians and Presbyterians and Episcopalians, and we're delighted that the Riverside Church, that's been such a leader in inclusion, not only in the city of New York, but in the country and throughout the world. You know, Dr. King spoke there, and we're delighted that they're our host.
That's really great. I've preached in that church several times, and it's a wonderful congregation, and one that, as you said, has been supportive of the kind of work that you're doing. You have an event coming up, March 13th. Who is that for?
The event on March 13th is called Women of Faith, Women of Doubt, and it's designed to, you know, promote the conversation about how the LGBT community and how the people who have been working since Beijing 20 years ago have been really pushing globally for economic development for women, helping young girls to attend schools, making sure that women's reproductive rights are available to all women throughout the world. What we're seeing, Weldon, is there's enormous pushback at the UN over the last maybe 8 years, where more conservative religious voices who have very clear views of traditional gender roles, that we're beginning to see many of the gains of the last 20 years since the Beijing meeting of the Commission on the Status of Women, that is being pushed back.
Where, if I may ask, where are those voices located? Is it widespread internationally, or are there pockets where you're hearing those voices?
Well, I remember attending the United Nations review of the International AIDS Plan in 2012, and a lot of really good work that was based on scientific proof of what works in terms of AIDS prevention and what were the groups that, how, you know, the most marginalized groups that were three or four times higher rates of infection for HIV. And a lot of really good work went into proposing the kind of the way in which the international community could proceed with the prevention of the spread of AIDS in the next 10 years. And there was a coalition of very conservative religious groups, groups from the Middle East, evangelical groups from the United States, and even some conservative Catholic groups, including the role of the Vatican, that we saw an attempt to kind of dislodge the conversation and to exclude some of these marginalized groups that we were concerned about. So you've got basically, you know, conservative Muslims, conservative evangelicals and Catholics that are represented by a number of NGOs at the UN, and they have been really pushing back on much of the progress that we've seen at the UN.
I know that your focus is on the upcoming United Nations Commission on the Status of Women meeting next month. Be specific about what role are you and the coalition taking on? What do you want to happen as a result of your presence there?
Well, we're concerned that the only significant religious voice in this public square right now is a very conservative and a very narrow view of the role of women or gender roles or the often the exclusion, the demonization of LGBT people. And we know that, for example, there are 80 countries where you have laws that actually discriminate against the equality of women. Often the laws are around the rights of property. And so we know that there's an economic impact on this discrimination, not only against women, but against LGBT people around the world. Some of the most impoverished people working in survival prostitution around the world are LGBT people. And I've seen that myself. I've seen it in Kampala. I've seen it in Cameroon. And the ways in which people are criminalized, they're put in prison, they're dehumanized. And often the religious community is in the front seat calling for these laws to be supported.
I'm curious. I mean, both initiatives are terribly important, but I'm interested in why you are trying to connect the cause of women's rights and LGBT rights, particularly in the global South, and how are you going to do that?
Well, again, we're seeing patterns here that, for instance, the way in which family has been defined at the United Nations over the last 50 years, family has been very loosely defined at the UN because the human race has very different forms of families. And there's been a reluctance to kind of define that. And we've seen in the last, maybe the last 2 or 3 years, probably the word family is the most controversial word that's being kicked around the UN these days. And there was a resolution passed by the UN Human Rights Council. We saw this in, about 2 years ago, led by Russia, that said that the Declaration of Human Rights, if your culture or religion had problems with gender equality, that you could opt out of these previous agreements. And so the idea that, you know, the family, this traditional entity, that we, you know, we're not going to accept something that's maybe being imposed from the West and so on. So there is controversy right now around what it means to be part of a family. And so some of us are concerned that, again, very traditional religious views are being used to oppress people.
Well, that's a terrific explanation and a great justification for doing the two issues together. Thanks for the explanation. How sizable is the opposition that you're going to encounter in doing this?
Well, we're just beginning a conversation. I mean, we're really trying to say, you know what? There are religious people out there, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, other faiths, that we believe in that people should be treated equally. People should have access to employment, to making a living that they can feed their children, that it's wrong to exclude people from families. It's wrong to put people in jail because they're gay or lesbian. So there are some of us working from a faith framework to think that all of that is wrong.
Let me ask the other side of that question then. Where are you finding support, and where are you thinking more support will come from?
Well, we started, you know, the St. Paul's Foundation, which is the organization that I'm working for, We started conversations with the World Bank maybe 3 years ago. And we didn't go in there saying LGBT rights or human rights. We didn't go in from that position at all. We said LGBT people are some of the most impoverished people on the planet right now. And the World Bank, with Jim Kim as its new leader, said he wanted to work with new communities to alleviate global poverty. So we said, here's a community that we'd like you to talk to. So we brought in about 20 people from around the world, and they basically talked about lack of access to jobs, mm-hmm. lack of access to health care. And so we've begun this really, really important conversation at the bank that is ending up in a serious discussion about some kind of safeguard that the international community would agree on, where women and LGBT people could be protected to have the same access to work, to schools, to health care as everybody else.
Albert, I'm curious, knowing the nature of your work, you are a religious leader. The United Nations is thought of as an amalgam of so many different traditions. How significant is religion as an influence in the deliberations of the United Nations?
Well, I think if you look at the world today, you know, the religion is playing a very important role, both in terms of reconciliation, bringing people together, keeping our eyes on the prize. We need to alleviate global poverty. Everybody agrees on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get groups like ISIS. You get, you know, conservative fundamentalism in many faiths that's doing enormous harm. And we're seeing that right now today all around the world. So the more we can bring people together, we can ask people, what is it that we have in common?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that we think is right, and what values can we share together that we have in common? That's basically the work that the UN, I think, is trying to do right now.
Albert, when you were with us a few years ago on a panel that also included Ugandan Bishop Christopher Senjoyo, I remember the emphasis that all of you placed on how crucial the leadership of local faith leaders in Africa and elsewhere is to counter oppression of minority communities. Are you seeing success in engaging more local faith leaders in this cause?
Well, I think if we look at Uganda, I mean, I think, you know, since we talked with you a couple of years ago, we had that horrible anti-gay law that was passed, and then the courts of Uganda threw out because it was unconstitutional and it was kind of anti-human rights as well. So it's funny that one arm of government is kind of challenging. But the sad thing is that since you and I talked last, the Interfaith Council of Uganda were up to their eyeballs in a campaign of hatred, that they basically made the way that this law happened. They pushed members of parliament to vote for it. So I heard actually a friend of mine told me that the Anglican Archbishop of Uganda very recently was preaching in Kampala in the cathedral, was showing pornography, and had a physician from Ethiopia, which is a country that's notoriously anti-gay, mm-hmm. that we have religious leaders who are still perpetuating misinformation, who are sensationalizing what is, you know, for me, a basic human rights position, that you've got to treat all your citizens equally.
Mm-hmm.
And the Interreligious Council, they lost a huge grant from USAID. They lost something like $6 million a year, because they were implicated in this campaign of terror.
Hmm.
So it's not looking good right now. You know, the mm-hmm. faith community, we really need to look at what we're doing.
The work that you're doing is work that is of interest to listeners to State of Belief Radio, and I want you to tell us how our listeners can stay informed about this new initiative that you're doing.
Well, we hope that people will really pay attention to this meeting of the Commission on the Status of Women. There will be 3,000 women coming from all over the world, and it's basically the report card of how we're doing on goals that we've set for the Millennium Development Goals, and the future sustainable development goals. So the big picture is to pay attention to the news, to look at how we're treating the majority of human beings right now. Are we moving forward? Are we moving backwards? Mm-hmm. And then aligned to that is how other minority groups, often who are oppressed by the same laws, the same challenges, how they are doing. So I hope that people will pay attention. The 8th of March through the 20th of March, that's when all these people will be in New York. It's a very exciting time for women and their allies to come together. And our panel will be at Riverside Church on the 13th of March, which is Friday night at 7 o'clock. There's going to be a reception. We're really excited about it. We've got great panelists lined up to begin this important dialogue.
The Reverend Canon Albert Ogle serves as Vicar of St. Peter's Lithgow in Millbrook, New York, a global activist for LGBT rights and HIV prevention efforts. He's president of San Diego-based St. Paul's Foundation for International Reconciliation. Albert, you're about another good initiative, and I wish you well in it. And also invite you, after you get through the meetings in March, if you have reflections on it, analyses of it that you want to share, that you'll get back in touch with us. We want to stay apprised of what's happening. And listen, thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. I want to thank you if you've made a financial donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Right after the show is a good time to take action on that. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. StateOfBelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/StateOfBelief. And share the stories you find compelling. Share them with your friends so that you can talk with them about this show and invite them to be a part of it as well. We're also at twitter.com/StateOfBelief. This is not a time that we can take anything for granted. If you find value in what you hear on this show, then please spread the word about State of Belief Radio. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?